Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. I'm glad to have you with us. The producers for the program are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. Well, there's no way to know what challenges that Barack Obama will be facing as president. However, one prediction that's pretty safe to make is that the Middle East will continue for him to be a major concern. This morning, in this hour of focus, we'll be trying to take a look at how those who came before him dealt with this region. And our guest is Patrick Tyler. He has a lot of experience as a journalist. He's had a career in newspapers that included a number of years at the Washington Post and at the New York Times, and he is the author of a newly published book. It's titled A World of Trouble, The White House and the Middle East, From the Cold War to the War on Terror. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. And it indeed takes a look at U.S. policy in the Middle East over a period of something like 50 years, 10 presidents, all of the way from Eisenhower to the current President Bush. And we'll be talking about this here in this hour of Focus 580. Questions, of course, are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Just a little bit more about our guest. He served as the bureau chief in both Moscow and Beijing, and also as military correspondent of the New York Times. Before joining the Times, he served as the Middle East bureau chief for the Washington Post, based in Cairo, where he covered the Arab world and Iran. He's authored two previous books, one, A Great Wall, Six Presidents and China, won a prize for the best book on international relations back in 2000. His first was A History of the U.S. Nuclear Submarine Program under Admiral Hyman Rickover. That book was published by Harper & Row in 86, the title Running Critical, The Silent War, Rickover and General Dynamics. So if you're interested, you can find those books. And certainly, you can go out to the bookstore and look for his current book, World of Trouble. And again, questions are certainly welcome. Mr. Tyler, hello.
Hello, I'm David. I'm happy to be here.
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate you giving us some of your time. Certainly, as I said, this book covers a lot of territory, and I am hoping that we'll get some questions and perhaps people will want to ask specifically about particular chapters here or particular presidents. I think, though, that there is one thing that's very clear that you make clear right from the get-go, and it seems to be something that it's true generally of U.S. foreign policy, not just foreign policy as applies to the Middle East, and is a problem. And it's something that I think certainly over time a lot of people have pointed to, and that is that as far as the Middle East is concerned, maybe a lot of other places, there, as you go from one administration to the next, there's no consistent policy. And in fact, there is this tendency of a new administration, an incoming administration, saying, well, we're not going to do things like they did it. We're going to do things differently. And so for that reason, you make this argument in the book that there never has been any kind of overarching policy about the Middle East, certainly not over the last 50 years.
Yeah, David, if you think about it, it's a very human trait for an incoming president wanting to make his own contribution and to distinguish himself from his predecessor by the policies he pursues. We all remember when the current president, George W. Bush, came into office after a 11th hour round of very intense diplomacy by his predecessor, Bill Clinton, to try and make peace between Yasser Arafat and Ehud Barak, the Israeli prime minister, and it failed right at the end of the administration. And George Bush came in and told his confidants and his associates that I've got very little political capital to spend. I've just come out of a close election. I'm not going to waste it on a process that is broken. I'm not going to turn the White House into a Motel 6 for Yasser Arafat. And I'm going to be very un-Clintonian because I want to distinguish myself from his record in every way I can. After all, he was a man of a different party with a whole different outlook on the world. And so that was probably the most recent and a rather dramatic example, but you can find them all through history. And if I can make just one additional point, The consistency that we showed in a general approach during the Cold War, I think, was reflective of the fact that there was this overarching threat to the existence of the planet by the balance of terror that existed all during those four decades of tension between the superpowers. The Middle East during this period was just a regional backwater, and so there was no need to have any kind of consistent or overarching policy toward the region. It was as each president defined it. Today, that former backwater has kind of displaced the Cold War as the obsessive objective of our total foreign policy. It is the Middle East now that consumes us, that threatens us with rogue nuclear weapons, with rogue states, etc., with terrorism that has come to our shores. And yet we haven't caught up with that notion that we need to present a united, bipartisan, and consistent approach to the region, because it is very, its problems and challenges are extremely diverse.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder how you would react to the suggestion that part of the problem here, that is our inability to do much in this region, has to do with the fact that the United States, that, you know, the governments in the region, they all have their own agendas, and that the United States truly doesn't really have a whole lot of leverage here. So whatever interest we might think that we would have, it's not, we don't have that many avenues to apply pressure to try to accomplish what it is we think we would like to accomplish.
Well, and yet we have dispatched our armies to the region more than once in the last 30 years, if you remember, starting with Eisenhower. He sent 19,000 troops into Lebanon in 1958 because it looked like the Egyptian dictator Nasser was going to try and overthrow the democratically constituted government there. The Persian Gulf War, we rolled back Saddam Hussein. We are in Iraq today, for better or for worse. We're trying to get out. We're in Afghanistan, which is tangential but connected to the region. And so we do have a lot of leverage. What we don't have is a lot of consistency in applying it, and we have lost some of our credibility in the standards we apply for applying it.
Let me raise one other point, because I'm sure that whenever there is conversation about U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, that what some people will say immediately, and we may indeed still hear from people after raising the question, is they will say, well, truly, the foreign policy of the United States has in the Middle East, at least for the last 50 years, has been driven by one thing and one thing only, and that is our need for continued access to a reliable supply of oil. What if you take a look at just that factor, that is our need for that commodity, would you say that in fact that has been, if not the leading concern, it's going to be one of the top concerns?
It lays in the background as a critical resource concern, David, is the way I would explain it. It does not drive a policy to in a predominant way, but it is always an important and present factor in the discussions and the considerations of every president. After all, what the two wars, world wars that we fought in the last century told us was that the powers that have access to the most reliable and robust supply of petroleum products is the party that has the best chance of victory in any world confrontation between powers. Hitler knew that as he raced across Russia trying to get to its oil fields and was stopped at the Battle of Stalingrad. Every president understood that. In the Middle East, you have this great crossroads, not only of oil pipelines, but of the communication links between East and West. The Mediterranean is a great basin of trade. The Suez Canal is this great link through the continents from East to West. And oil is a big part of it. But we also got to remember that culturally, the great civilization sprung in that region also. Judeo-Christian Islamic faith and culture comes out in great parallel arcs, and the conflicts between those cultures also are a big part of the colonial period grievances that grew up and that when the powers were the colonial powers were stripped away after World War II, these grievances kind of exploded into the politics of the region that we know today as Arab nationalism, Islamic awakening, Islamic nationalism. All of these things are political manifestations, and they're not connected directly to oil. Oil is there in the background. It's a critical factor, but I wouldn't say it's the dominant factor.
The guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Patrick Tyler. He's reported extensively from both the Middle East and Washington for the New York Times and the Washington Post. He's the author of a newly published book that looks at U.S. policy in the Middle East from Eisenhower to the current President Bush. And I'm sure that he will have some things to say about perhaps what things would look like for the next president, Barack Obama. The title of his book is A World of Trouble, The White House in the Middle East, From the Cold War to the War on Terror. Farah Strauss-Giroux is the publisher. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We can try to talk a little bit specifically about particular presidents, but I guess I would ask first a kind of a general question. I'm sure each administration you can find things to point to, either high points or low points as far as the Middle East is concerned. But is it possible to say that there was a particular president that you think overall had, in a sense, the best experience or achieved the most positive things that you could point to?
Yeah, I think the record for success is rather... thin. Each president since Eisenhower has tried to make a contribution toward peace. It's been very difficult for them. President Eisenhower, you'd have to say, tried very hard in the mid-1950s after Israel had been created and you had hundreds of thousands of Arab refugees, Palestinians, we later started calling them, living in squalid camps on the edges, on the periphery of the Holy Land. And Eisenhower thought, well, you know, if in the United States we can use hydroelectric power to create new agricultural vistas, why can't we take dam projects to the Holy Land and turn the barren hills of the West Bank and the Jordan Valley into a new agricultural mecca that will solve this refugee problem, draw them out onto farms. And Eisenhower was quite excited about this, and he sent a special envoy out to talk to both sides about it. But the Israelis weren't interested at that time in sharing the water, and the Palestinians just weren't ready. They weren't politically together. They were still angry, and they were unorganized. And so peace did not break out as Eisenhower had hoped. I think you have to look... You have to look to President Carter as probably scoring the biggest achievement with the Camp David Accords in 1978 that led to the Egyptian-Israeli peace in 1979, because Egypt, after all, was Israel's greatest and largest enemy and the source of the biggest wars, from the Suez Conflict to the Six-Day War in 1967 to the Yom Kippur War in 1973, was all the Egyptian army against the Israeli army. And to shut down that source of conflict was a great achievement. I don't think Jimmy Carter wasn't reelected. He had the Iranian revolution break out on his watch and had to contend with the hostage crisis in the last half of his term. And so that achievement was somewhat lost in his presidency, but it stands in history as quite a strong achievement.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is, you know, something that now that comes to my mind here that essentially interestingly enough, links these two presidents together. And when one thinks about Eisenhower and what the U.S. did in the Middle East, I think some people would point to perhaps the most problematic thing, the thing that later then came to be a real problem for the United States, was the coup in Iran in 1953 that we were involved in, where we replaced a democratically elected government with the Shah. This was something that when it came to the Iranian Revolution and Jimmy Carter, something that perhaps a lot of Americans had forgotten, but the Iranians certainly didn't forget it.
No, they didn't, and it was a source of grievances. When I talked earlier about that wellspring of grievances in the post-colonial period, that's one of the hot issues that gripped one entire society. The Iranians were very proud people, and they resented the fact that the British had come into their country, discovered oil, and were consuming that oil and selling it to the West, enriching themselves while poverty reigned in Iran. And they elected a nationalist prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, and the British were infuriated when Mossadegh nationalized their Abadan oil refinery and all of their oil assets in Iran, and began conspiring with the CIA. I mean, it wasn't just the United States. It was Eisenhower and Winston Churchill who went after Mossadegh because he was a threat to that critical post-war focus on the expansion of oil supplies for the West in case we had to go back to war against the Soviet Union.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, just let me introduce again, Patrick Tyler. He is a correspondent, has been a correspondent for both the New York Times and the Washington Post. He's reported from the Middle East. He's also reported from Russia and from China. And he is the author of a new book. It's A World of Trouble, The White House and the Middle East, From the Cold War to the War on Terror. And the book is published by Ferrer, Strauss, and Giroux. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think when... If we move on and talk a little bit about Richard Nixon, I think when one thinks about foreign policy in the Nixon administration and places where the United States was involved and had difficulty, certainly the first thing you're going to think about is Vietnam. And then when it comes to foreign policy, I suppose, and something that was arguably an achievement, you think about the relationship between China and the United States. And I don't know that you really think very much about the Middle East. And what sort of involvement did the Nixon administration have in the region?
Well, Richard Nixon came into office with a very special set of problems, as you recall. I mean, he realized that if he didn't come up with a plan to get the United States out of Vietnam, that there would be no second term for Richard Nixon. So his focus, understandably, coming into office was on how to get out of Vietnam. And he went straight to the Soviets in looking for help in that enterprise. His other focus after the Soviets weren't so helpful in that regard was then shift back to China because he thought maybe Mao and Zhou Enlai, the Chinese leadership, could help bring the Vietnamese to the negotiating table. The Middle East was a backwater immediately for him, and he left it to his first Secretary of State, William Rogers, to basically fiddle and piddle with the Middle East and try and keep the lid on. I mean, Nixon thought it was a tinderbox, an explosive tinderbox, he didn't have time to deal with it in that first term. The first term was all about Vietnam. In the second term, he had Watergate to contend with almost immediately, just as a great opportunity for peacemaking came along to avert a war breaking out again. In fact, the most interesting anecdotes in my book is the night in June of 1973, when Leonid Brezhnev, the Soviet leader, literally got Richard Nixon out of bed during their talks in San Clemente to tell him that the Soviets thought war was coming again in the Middle East and the superpowers ought to intervene to head it off. And I think Nixon, if you remember, that was the summer of the Irvin Watergate hearings. Nixon was so fearful that a big initiative in the Middle East would trigger a neuralgic reaction in the Senate, which was full of pro-Israeli senators who would object to any pressure being applied to Israel in any kind of initiative, and so he just walked away from it. And as a result, 4 months later, war did break out, and one of the most destructive wars of the modern period. And Israel's army this time was caught by surprise, and they had almost 3,000 battle deaths, and that set off terrible recriminations in their society. So there's an example where domestic politics, the scandal of a president, paralyzed him at a critical moment when a peace opportunity, a war aversion opportunity, really stood out.
Mm-hmm. There, I suppose that suggests that another one sort of way that you could divide things up and look at American policy in the Middle East is, say, during the time that the Cold War was still on, and then post-Cold War, so sort of ask when the line is drawn, what it was like before and what it was like after, which prompts a question. Were there many occasions here when, say, during the Cold War, when, like this one, someone either in the United States or in the Soviet Union said, look, here, this is something that we should work together on, and that if both of us, if the United States and the Soviet Union does come together, agree on a kind of a plan, exerts pressure where we can, that we could actually achieve something working together?
Well, I think the first time that happened certainly was, or the most dramatic time, was in the Nixon administration when, as you recall, President Nixon pursued a policy of detente with the Soviet Union, and he wanted to demonstrate that a cautious relationship with the Soviet leadership could lead to some cooperation on reconciling conflicts in the world and preventing war from breaking out that would pose the threat of drawing the superpowers in to a confrontation. And, you know, the Soviets had different interests than ours. They backed the Arabs, and they liked the idea that we were backed into the kind of corner in international public relations of being the only major defender of Israel. And they liked that symmetry because it got them more influence among the Arab states. And they were arming the Arab states, and we were arming Israel, and there was a kind of a balance of power we were trying to maintain in the region. Nixon saw that he and Brezhnev, if they took it on as a feature of detente, could probably force a comprehensive peace agreement in the Middle East that had been festering since the Six-Day War, when Israel had seized so much territory in their lightning defeat of the Arab armies. And he really wanted to go after that. But the problem was Watergate was bringing his administration down. Henry Kissinger, who was his most talented enabler, was very cautious and very reluctant to be the ramrod for such a negotiation because it would cause him to put pressure on the Israeli leadership at a time when he didn't want to set off any opposition in the Senate to him, Kissinger, making the transition from Nixon to Ford. Kissinger wanted to survive, and I think this is where his personal interest diverged from that of President Nixon. And here you have a case where the great personalities around a president can be very important factors in how policy is made or unmade.
And that's an excellent example, and I'm sure that there are others, and it underscores the point that, yes, indeed, the president can certainly make policy, but he relies on people to carry it out. And if those people have their own agendas, they may indeed either bend it in certain ways, or might in fact simply decide not to do what it is that the president wants.
Yes, yes. Powerful adjutants and influential aides are a real factor in if you want to study how a presidency works and how a president comes into office and tries to formulate and execute a foreign policy that reaches out to the world. A critical factor is how he is able and how he succeeds or doesn't succeed in marshaling the personnel forces to do that.
We are midway through here. We have a caller to take, someone calling in from Champaign. We'll get right to them. The number, by the way, if you'd like to join the conversation, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana callers. We do also have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And again, our guest is Patrick Tyler. He's reported for both The Washington Post and The New York Times, and he's the author of the book A World of Trouble, The White House and the Middle East, From the Cold War to the War on Terror. Farah Strauss-Giroux is the publisher and takes a look at U.S. policy in the Middle East from Eisenhower to the current President Bush. We have a caller here. We'll get right to them in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, sir. I'm very conflicted about the Palestinian-Israeli conflagration now, and I was even more so with the Hezbollah-Israeli problem, I believe, in 2006 over in Lebanon. My question to you, and I have difficulty getting balanced reports of this conflict from the local as well as the national media, partly because I think the Israelis aren't allowing the Western media into Gaza, which I find anti-democratic, even though Israel is the democracy of the region. How do you account for, in the case of the Bush administration, and one of my colleagues says Obama/Clinton will be no differently, this blind adherence to this notion, in my estimation, of Israel, right or wrong, so be it, from the United States perspective?
Well, that's a very good question. It is very hard to get a full and nuanced report every day on what is going on in Gaza today, a confrontation between the Israeli military and the Hamas militants that run the Gaza Strip, this very densely populated piece of land sandwiched between southern Israel and the Egyptian border, in which about 1.5 million people live, many of them refugees from the 1948 civil war that in which the state of Israel was created. I think that the tail end of the caller's question about support for Israel is one of those issues of consistency among presidents that has suffered over the decades, is that each president has tried to either establish a greater sense of arm's length from the Israeli leadership to engage both the Arab world leadership and the Israelis in some equal fashion, and to project the role of a honest and neutral broker in trying to mediate the fundamental, the core dispute, which is, after all, the competition between two national movements, Palestinian and Israeli, on the same land. It is been the character of some presidents to embrace the Jewish and Israeli narrative a little more closely. I think the current president, George W. Bush, has spent 8 years very much in greater sympathy to the Israeli point of view that it is essentially a collegial power fighting terror as the United States is fighting terror, and he has seen very little subtlety in the historic conflict. I think the president who preceded him, Bill Clinton, I think probably was among the smartest presidents who's served in the Oval Office, maybe perhaps not the most disciplined or decisive. But he mastered, I think, the narrative of both cultures very thoroughly, deeply, in a way that allowed him to have empathy for each side's historical narrative. It made him a very good mediator, though he ran out of time and was so undermined by his own foibles, his own scandals and whatnot, that he was not able to close the deal. A deal that still lays there on the table very close to conclusion, and which a new president, President-elect Obama, will be looking at when he enters office. I think you have the potential today to be as optimistic as ever, because there is so much international will that has been built up to support a return to diplomacy and peacemaking in the region, and there may be a very good chance in the coming 8 years.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. I'm sure that from administration to administration, or within administrations, there have been times when the U.S. government was frustrated with Israel. And one time in particular that comes to mind was the famous case where James Baker, who is the Secretary of State, was testifying before Congress and sat there and gave the White House telephone number and said something like, "And you know, when Israel's really serious about peace, give us a call." Well, most of the time, I think administrations don't. They don't say stuff like that strong about their frustration, but certainly they go on the record, and as far as I can recall, every administration is always going to say, yes, we believe, we support Israel. You know, having said all that, has there really been that much difference from one administration to the next in their commitment, the level of their commitment to Israel?
No, I think at the ground level, America's commitment to the security of Israel, the Zionist proposition of a Jewish state in the old Palestinian province of the Ottoman Empire is absolute. And I think every president since Truman has made that recommitment. But Beyond that is where all the trouble lies for policymakers, because even though that commitment is accepted, there are all sorts of ancillary questions on how strong a power the United States needs to make Israel by selling it weapons and supporting its various military adventures in the region, an invasion of Lebanon here, a bombing of the Iraqi nuclear reactor there, how strong, and in the future perhaps a full confrontation with Iran that Israel may have a strong interest in pursuing with the new administration. So there are all sorts of questions above this fundamental that the United States supports the security and safety of the Jewish state. That's just where policy then begins, and that is still quite a complex question.
All right, we have some other callers. Next, we'll talk with someone in Columbus, Ohio, obviously listening online. Line 4, hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I'm kind of curious. I've got a hypothetical to start with. My understanding was that during the course of World War II, we basically made equivalent, well, the Allied powers basically made equivalent promises to the Jewish population and to the Arab population that if you stay on our side and help us, you will get Palestine. And then, of course, when the war was over, you couldn't give the same land to two people. But out of the Balfour negotiations, my understanding is that Israel wasn't the only piece of land that was considered as a possibility to be given to the Jewish population. I'm just wondering what would have happened if instead of giving Palestine to what became the Israelis, if they had been settled in Sudan or even in South America, which is what I understand was the other alternative that was being considered. Basically, I don't think that there would be a Middle East problem, or at least not on the magnitude that it exists today. Am I too far off on that?
Well, I think you're a little bit off, only in this sense. I mean, you're right. There have been very attractive offers that were made to the Zionist movement in the last century and the late 19th century. Someone came up with the idea of giving them Uganda for a Jewish state, and there's quite a famous Israeli military commander who got sent to Uganda as a defense attaché many years later, and he just says as an aside in his memoir account of those years, he says, with the lush, green, fertile land that I saw there and the wonderful vistas, I started to wonder whether we made the wrong choice. But the reason it was never really seriously considered by the majority of in the Zionist movement was because of Jerusalem. And at Jerusalem, you have the lodestone of faith of the old Jewish temples and the Wailing Wall that is so inextricably connected with the religious aspirations of the Jewish people that you can't separate Judaism just as you can't separate Catholicism or Islam from this holy city where so much history occurred, religious history and religious nationalism occurred. This is where Solomon built his temple. This is where Nebuchadnezzar came and tore it down in the 5th century B.C. This is where the Romans came and dispersed the Jews into the diaspora. And this is where religious Jews came migrating back over the centuries until they had again built up a formidable local population by the 19th century as one of the dominant ethnic groups, religious groups, living in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the call of Judaism, and in so many dinner tables across Europe in the early part of the last century, people ended their blessing over the food by saying, next year in Jerusalem. So that's why it doesn't really work to take the Jews to some other part of the world and settle this dispute geographically. It has to be settled by the competing nationalities who must live together in the same Holy Land.
I want to thank the caller. We're getting into our last 20 minutes here, and I have some others that I wanted to get onto. And also for anybody who has just joined us, perhaps I should introduce again our guest, Patrick Tyler. He's a journalist, author. His career in newspapers include 12 years at the Washington Post, 14 years at the New York Times, where he was chief correspondent from 2002 until 2004. He anchored the Times coverage of the invasion of Iraq in 2003, established the Baghdad Bureau of the Times after the fall of Saddam Hussein. He also served as bureau chief for the Times in Moscow and in Beijing. And before joining the Times, he served as Middle East bureau chief for the Washington Post based in Cairo, where he covered the Arab world and Iran. And he is the author of a recently published book that looks at the history of U.S. policy in the Middle East and how different presidents from Eisenhower to the current President Bush approached the Middle East. The title of his book is A World of Trouble, and it's published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. And we have other callers here. And next, we will talk with someone here where we are, Champaign County, line two. Hello.
Hi. Since you're trying to draw such a broad spectrum, a stroke on this, it seems to me that I'll have to argue with your saying that for the U.S., oil isn't the dominant factor. It seems to me if you just look at the grand area strategy planning after World War or during World War II, George F. Kennan's famous quote about how the Middle East is the oil and under the Middle East is the greatest prize in the world, and you know that's a well-known quote, but it doesn't seem to actually come up enough. The other point I wanted to make is there's just so much. So many commonplaces about the way we talk about the Middle East that are just wrong. Lies are misunderstandings are both. We have the example from contemporary, the Gaza situation, where, one, it's a commonplace in American discourse that Hamas broke the truce. Well, it's not true. The attack into Gaza on November 13th by Israel was what really broke the truce. The Hamas went as far as putting some of the other rocket firers in jail when they were enforcing the truce. I'm not an apologist for Hamas in any way, but the commonplaces, we have Condi Rice at the Security Council saying that Hamas took over in a coup, a putsch, she called it. I mean, that's ridiculous. She was the one who was backing an election, and they won fair and square. And the altercation between Hamas and Fatah was followed a building up of Fatah forces that were going to take Gaza back, and it was a preemptive strike on Fatah. Again, I think both of the organizations are problematic, but I think the U.S. government is the biggest actor in the region, and it isn't that we've been sitting by idly. We've been arming, mainly one side.
Well, I think you make a good point when you say that the words that are spoken by officials, once ceasefire breaks down, once war breaks out, become a kind of a competitive lawyer's brief of setting blame. And after all, the task of diplomacy in large measure is avoiding blame and placing it elsewhere. This is a very old conflict. Even since Israel withdrew from Gaza in 2005, you almost have to parse and slice the bologna day by day to get a full understanding of how complex the conflict has grown and how difficult it has been for any outside mediator to make a difference without a major intervention, which no outside power has been willing to contemplate. And therefore, you leave Israel in the impossible position of having to defend border areas that are virtually under the control of no one except these young men with hoods and Katyusha rockets on their shoulders seeking to extricate themselves from the burden of the grievance they have felt since childhood, since birth, against the Israeli occupier. And the viciousness and the poison of the relationships is reflected in the statements. The Israelis at this moment are seem to be extremely unified, that they're doing the right thing, that regardless of the fact that they may have broken the ceasefire in November, that they are simply fighting for the security of their people and the right of their citizens to live without having ballistic projectiles crashing into their homes and their schools and their places of business. But all that being said, everybody knows that this conflict can't really be solved by the parties, that it requires the active and robust intervention by friendly Arab powers on the periphery, Egypt and Jordan and Saudi Arabia being the most important, and by the European and great powers, the United States being the most important. And there's a great pause in the world waiting for the new American administration to distinguish itself, if you will, from its predecessor, by more robustly engaging this conflict and coming up with some innovative and new thinking about how to get a new ceasefire, stop the rockets coming out of Gaza, and help unify the Palestinians so that they can have what all sides seem to want at this point, which is a two states side by side, Palestinian and Israeli, living in some kind of security and peace.
Well, you just brought up one of the other commonplaces of the current situation, and that's the idea that Israel withdrew. Well, it withdrew settlers, it withdrew, but it's at the periphery. Actually, I've heard someone argue just recently that blockading a territory, as they have done, is an act of war. So, and that was one of the things that the truce was supposed to eliminate. I'm extremely frustrated by the situation and the language and the misrepresentation that is going on. I see it everywhere. And
by the point you're making, though, I think your frustration is warranted. The point you're making is that people make statements that don't feel honest, because the conflict is underway and people are representing their camps, and it's almost a tribal clash. And what you need in a situation like that is some mechanism to cool things down. There have been some important voices in Israel over the last few years that have said, including Shlomo Gazit, who used to be the director of military intelligence, who have said, we ought to spend a little less time listening to what Hamas says and engage them about, you know, what kind of coexistence they would like to have with Israel in the long term. And Hamas has talked about having 30-year truces and has made such offers in the past. It has been very difficult given the political climate in Israel, where its national politics are such that we are on the cusp of a new era. Elections are coming in February, and you have Bibi Netanyahu coming from the right against Ehud Barak and Tzipi Livni, who are in the center or on the left, and a great struggle over what the new course of Israeli leadership is going to take, especially on the peace front. And it makes for a very difficult time to manage the conflict in a way that minimizes rhetoric or violence when you've got so much at stake for both sides.
Just quickly, I would like to try to get some other callers, but as to the question of what the policy of the Obama administration might be, we've talked about how incoming presidents like to distinguish themselves from past administrations. Here now, though, his Secretary of State is going to be Hillary Clinton, which has led some people to think that, well, perhaps the administration, the Barack Obama administration, their approach would be something like the Clinton administration.
Yes, but I think it's always a mistake to look at incoming secretaries of state as if they are the policy guru of the new administration. The actual trend in recent decades has been for more and more power and foreign policy formulation to converge in the White House and the National Security Council. It doesn't mean that Hillary Clinton won't prove to be an extremely influential member of the team. She will, to the extent that she proves herself as an extremely useful facilitator, visionary, staff aide, idea person for a president who is seems to be a very hands-on kind of person. I mean, we've yet to see him from the, you know, come out of the starting gate, but the way he ran his campaign, he strikes, I think, the country here at the beginning, at the near the starting line, as someone who's decisive, organized, and focused. And if that's the case, the Secretary of State will play to him, not the other way around.
All right, let's talk with someone in Decatur, line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I'd like to get your reflections upon the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty. Where were you, and what did you think, and why do you think our response was so flaccid compared to the more than overwhelming response to the attack on the USS Cole? Thanks.
Well, it's a very good question, one that rises from history, and for the listeners who don't know about this, is the USS Liberty was an intelligence collection ship of the United States Navy that was in international waters off of the Mediterranean coastline during the Six-Day War between Israel and Egypt in 1967, and I forgot exactly which day of the war, the 8th or the 9th day, the 7th day, well, there was a 6-day war, I'm sorry, the 4th or the 5th day of the war. The Liberty was attacked by air and by sea by Israeli forces, even though it was flying the American flag and had English lettering and numbering on its hull. And was not configured as a warship. From President Johnson to Secretary of State Dean Rusk to CIA Director Richard Helms and many other senior officials in the administration, it was an appalling attack. And they found it inconceivable that the Israelis couldn't figure out that that was not a hostile ship when they attacked it. And of course, scores of Americans died and were injured as they continued to pound the ship with various kinds of weapons for more than an hour. I think the most authoritative historical dissections of that incident have demonstrated I think beyond not a shadow of doubt have demonstrated predominantly, I would say, that the Liberty was not a deliberate attack preconceived by the Israeli leadership, that when Israeli forces started attacking, they were on the radio and all of the communications between pilots and ships and controllers have been declassified and provided for investigators and historians. But that you can find that once one of the pilots and one of the controllers said that this might be an American, that the attack continued during a period of uncertainty, and planes and ships came around to fire more and more weapons, even though it had been said over the communications net that this might be an American. And of course, when that finally became more certain, the attack stopped. But there was quite a competition between the Israeli air and sea forces to get the kill of this suspected enemy combatant at the time. And that may have driven the attack forward, as well as other factors of just the fog of war. So my personal belief is that the most you can say that this was a terrible case of negligence and one that therefore deserved the very, very strong statement that Dean Rusk issued to the Israeli leadership in the wake of this tragedy.
We have about a minute or two. We'll try real quick to go to our caller here in Paxton. If you can be very quick, we can get you in. Go ahead.
Recently, I listened to a Jewish scholar who said that after the setup of Israel, there was ethnic cleansing going on there. Who was the American presidency on the watch then, and why wasn't anything said? These people are now in Gaza. If there had been some demographic solution then with the Arabs staying in Israel, this whole problem could have been alleviated.
But that's a very good point. The problem could have been alleviated had there been a major power on the ground to enforce the partition of the Holy Land into Arab and Jewish states at the time. But the reality is that the British military was the power at the time, and it marched out, and it triggered a civil war between Arabs and Jews, and they fought to the boundaries that they were able to hold on to, and that's what determined the early borders.
Well, we're at the point here where we're going to have to finish. And as I said at the beginning, the book covers an awful lot of territory, 50 years, 10 presidents. Again, any sort of major, aside from the first thing that we talked about, the lack of consistency, any other sort of major conclusion that you draw by looking at all of this?
Only that a president must deal with the constituencies and the domestic politics in his own environment as effectively as he deals with the parties and the conflict overseas. It requires a sustained effort and a major push in Congress to hold the important domestic constituencies together as the president is applying pressure on the parties in the region to make compromises that are very difficult for their populations. And so that takes a lot of support, and it takes a lot of organized support by a White House that has to reach out to the Jewish community, the Arab community, as well as to allies overseas to hold it all together. And that takes discipline and determination.
Our guest, Patrick Tyler, he worked 12 years at the Washington Post, 14 years at the New York Times, reported from Moscow, from Beijing, and also from the Middle East. He is the author of a newly published book, A World of Trouble, The White House and the Middle East, From the Cold War to the War on Terror. It takes a look at the history of U.S. Policy in the Middle East over the last 50 years. Farah Strauss-Giroux is the publisher. Mr. Tyler, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.